This is an interview with Mark Davis of the Tidewater Unix User Group, which I recorded a couple of months ago. Because of various occurrences in my private life, I was unable to get it edited until now. Unfortunately, in this, the first interview that I attempted to do, I found out that I really need a new microphone for doing interviews. I have tried to salvage my end of the sound as best I can. Fortunately, Mark's end of the sound came out very well, so I urge you to overlook my inadequacies and listen to him tell his story of over 25 years of involvement with Unix and Linux. Thank you. Hello, this is Frank Bell again. I'm here with Mark Davis. Mark is the head, the unofficial head, as there are no elected officers, the unofficial head of the Tidewater Unix User Group, also known as TWUG. The group functions very much as a community, but Mark is very much our leading spirit. A little bit of intro. When I moved to this part of the world a couple of years ago, I moved from an area where I did not have a lug that was at all convenient for me to attend. The nearest one was well over an hour and a half away in the evening traffic. So I was overjoyed when I got here and found there was an active users group, and even better, it's 15 minutes away from my house. So I thought it might be interesting to hear a little bit of Mark's story. So Mark, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Well, right now I'm the Director of Information Systems and Communications at Lake Taylor Transitional Care Hospital in Norfolk. And we do use our current facility as the to host TWUG. And like you said, I think of myself as kind of a benevolent dictator when it comes to TWUG. I don't like to use that word, but you're right that we don't have any elected officers and nobody seems interested in using Robert's rules or making it more complicated than it needs to be. So we pretty much just act as an informal group.
Okay, and of course I can see, since you're the person with the meeting room, that would give you kind of a leg in to being the leader of the group. Just for curiosity, what is a transitional hospital?
Well, Lake Taylor has a long history, about 120-something years, and it used to be a part of the city where people would go for indigent care, and its role has changed dramatically over the past 120 years. Right now, you can think of us as a long-term or rehab-type hospital and also a nursing home combined. So our role is a little unique when it comes to healthcare, which is interesting because we do use Linux and we use Unix and have pretty much since we started using computers. So an unusual facility using an unusual, you know, at least as far as the business community goes, an unusual operating system.
Well, I think that leads into why did you and the hospital make the choice to use a Linux-based network?
Well, as you probably know, way back when, before there was an MS Windows or several other operating systems, Unix was probably the premier operating system, or was the premier operating system for use in all business-type systems. And when I came to Lake Taylor in 1989, they had already purchased a system from what's called a VAR, or value-added reseller. Their name was Monette Information Systems. They're based in Smithfield. And, you know, back then, it was computers were very expensive, and we had just passed the mini-computer phase and into the microcomputer phase, but multi-user was a very cost-effective way of running a system. So we had a single Altos system, a 986T, for anyone that's listening that remembers the Altos systems. And the Altos 986T ran Xenix, and it was a multi-user system. And at the same time I was hired, which was early in 89, they had just upgraded the platform to an Altos, I think it was an Altos 2000, can't remember exactly, but Altos was a big name in multi-user Unix computers. And the different areas of the building, there were probably about 10 terminals, and they were literally terminals, Altos terminals, but they were more VT100 WISE, you know, type terminals, where people would log into it and use the accounting software, which was the primary purpose for it being there. When I got there, that's pretty much all it was used for, was accounting and payroll. And we quickly expanded and added more machines. I mean, just to let you know how terrifying it is to depend on a VAR, they didn't have a, you know, being a small company, they didn't have an IT department, or MIS is what it used to be called, Management Information Systems. And so they started small. They hired me. I was part-time. I was still going to ODU, earning my degree in computers, and so it was an excellent opportunity for me and for them, so they could get slave labor for a while, as you know how that is with your first job.
And you've been there ever since?
I have. I've actually worked in several other places too, but that was my first, I would say, real job. Although the prior to that, I was in a small computer store named Bits and PCs, which probably nobody's heard of, but building computers and helping people. And before that, I worked at Radio Shack, and that was my dream job from being a child. Of course, what you think of as a child and going into adulthood are totally different things when you realize it's definitely not the dream job. But I do like to interrupt myself. I do that all the time. What was I talking about? Was
Radio Shack.
No. Before that, we were talking about the hospital. Oh, when I got there, they didn't have anybody to help them. So they depended on this VAR, you know, which was off-site support. And the way the system was originally set up, it was multi-user, but they didn't even have usernames. They were logging in as programs. Like they would log in as AP, or they would log in as AR for accounts receivable, or things like that. And so the system had no idea their user identities or anything, because that was the way the VAR set it up. So I was, you know, going into that environment, I was terrified. I was like, I cannot believe they have this set up this way. So the very first thing I did was assign login names to everybody, teach people how to have a real password, and then I set up email, and then we set up word processing and all this on the Altos 2000 system.
So you were in it from the beginning there at the hospital.
Well, I'm not that old. I'm not from the beginning of the facility, but definitely from the beginning of computer usage. Yeah, and as you probably guessed, we followed an upgrade path that led to another Altos system, an Altos 15,000, and that upgraded to Altos Unix instead of Xenix. And then after that, we upgraded to SCO Open Server, or SCO ODT. Now,
our friend SCO, yes.
Now remember, back then, SCO was not a dirty word. They were just another Unix distribution. That was what you're thinking of nowadays, you know, is the SCO group, which is what became what was left of SCO after Linux pretty much took over SCO's marketplace. But, you know, it was a capable operating system, and, you know, people would make fun of it, especially Solaris people, you know, the toy Unix. But we would use that until we had upgraded to an HP 15,000, and I think that was also running SCO ODT. Then we upgraded to, what did we use after that? Oh, from that point we moved into Linux, so which is what a lot of businesses did. In fact, at the time, Linux had backwards compatibility with SCO Open Server, because it could run Xenix binaries and also i386 COF binaries. I don't know if anyone remembers those. But
no, I've never heard of them.
I could actually run some of the programs that directly without recompiling them, so that or getting a different version from the vendor. So that worked out really well, and we've been Linux ever since. So you're not going to find very many businesses that have always used Unix, Linux. We're probably one of the very few that we just never left. You know, a lot of companies were romanced by the whole PC type architecture, and not that we haven't had a few in the building, you know, for specific purposes, but
Windows NT.
Well, fortunately, we never really tried to get into that. But yeah, Microsoft's first foray into multi-user was not very romantic and not very pretty. Reminds me of some of the Citrix-type stuff that later came built on NT, and it was just not very good. It's, of course, improved dramatically since then, but my point was that we just never... It's not that we defected and left any other platform. We just... Unless you want to think of going from Unix to Linux as a different platform.
It's just been an organic development from Unix to Linux rather than leaving home and then coming back the prodigal child chastened and hungry.
That's right. And of course, you know, we have it's always fun to have auditors come in, you know, or something, and they're looking at our systems trying to figure out what they are and being completely baffled, you know. So, yeah, you know, we always get surveys, you know, well, which email server do you use? And I was like, well, we don't. It's just, you know, PostFix. It's just part of Linux. Well, where's your print server? It's like, we don't have a print server or an email server or a login server or a web server. I said, they're all that box right there. And they're like, what do you mean? I said, well, the whole hospital runs on this one box. And this is way before, you know, IBM came along and with their virtualization, you know, their big thing on Linux. And they had this fun ad where they had this big room and said, oh, the servers are gone. The servers are gone. I don't know if, did you ever see that one? And the police came in and
I can't say I remember it, but I am very good at tuning out ads of all sorts.
I am too, especially with TiVo, another Linux powered device. But the whole room was empty, and there was nothing but this one little computer in the corner, and they were saying, oh, it's all running on that now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was when, yes, believe it or not, IBM was heavy into pushing Linux at one time on their virtualized machines. So. But philosophically, I think of everything, it's more than just the fact that we run Linux. It's also a centralized system, which is another unusual, didn't used to be unusual, you know, when I came up with computers, the idea of sharing a computer among many different people was logical.
I remember when I was at my first job out of college, it was a fairly large organization, and among other things, they had an economist, some economists on staff to do projections and the like. I got to be friendly with one of them, and I remember him taking his phone handset and putting it in the old cradle. I forget what they're called.
It's an acoustic modem coupler, yeah.
And dialing up the timeshare on some mainframe that was located God knows where, somewhere elsewhere in the city.
Yeah, that was very common back then. And what I think is interesting is that philosophically, centralized versus distributed computing has always been there. And a pendulum swings between being distributed and being centralized. It moves back and forth. They both have wonderful advantages and disadvantages. And, of course, there are hybrids because no system is purely, you know, centralized or purely distributed. If you look at your computer, your laptop that you're using right now, you might think, well, this is a very, you know, distributed type system. It's your own computer. But nowadays, you know, a computer not connected to a network and sharing with the internet and the rest of the world seems kind of ludicrous. But that's, again, if you use any kind of web-based mail, that's a very centralized concept. If you have anything in the cloud, you know, like email, I mean, not email, files or music or anything like that, that's all centralized. If you use Amazon to order things, that's even the concept of a website, it's very centralized. You're going back to a single server or a set of servers that look like a single server. So at Lake Taylor, we are a centralized system where we use essentially X terminals, because we had evolved from ASCII terminals or text-based terminals to X terminals back when Tektronix, I don't know if you remember them, but they made X terminals. The whole concept of X11, the X windowing environment, is network transparent and network based, and was essentially designed for the idea of sharing expensive mainframe type computers with graphical desktops. It was just an evolution of going from text based to graphical based, and X is very elegant for that. And people forget nowadays, especially with all this Wayland thing. Don't get me started on that. You know how I feel about Wayland. I mean, I think the network transparency and the network functions within the windowing environment is very important for reasons that a lot of people don't understand the history of. And, of course, we use that right now actively. And it's as simple as set up an X server and just point it at the display manager, the XDM manager, which is my centralized computer. And bam, you get a login screen, you log in. All the programs run on the server, well, server and client, are a little confused in X. You know, when you say X server, it's actually running on your machine close to you.
So Mark, how do you feel about Wayland?
Oh, well, you're going to pull me into that, huh? That's...
In 1 minute or less, can you tell us what you think about Wayland?
I'm not opposed to the idea, of course, of moving forward. Things change, and I'm, like a lot of people in TWUG, I'm somewhat conservative, especially because I've been around computers so long. People come along and just say, well, there are problems with X11, it doesn't do this or doesn't do that, or So let's just throw it out and design something brand new. And oh, by the way, it'll be backwards compatible, so you can run your X-based programs under Wayland. It's like, well, it's not that simple, because the moment that something else starts taking over, like Wayland, popular programs such as Firefox or whatnot may not be available as an X-based version anymore. And those people that choose to use X, because they're using a centralized system or they like their network transparency and they can launch programs remotely and very efficiently through SSH or however they want to manage their systems, will be denied access to that program. Because either that or you'll have different versions. You'll have a Wayland version and you'll have an X version. That's kind of the way the approach that Apple used. You know, they didn't, as you know, their Unix-based kernel, but they didn't use X11 as their windowing environment. They was based on Next and Display PostScript at the time, and it created incompatibilities. Now, yes, they have an X server, so you can run X programs, but all the Mac programs are going to be essentially designed
for Mac.
Right, just to use on Mac. So it's good for them, but it's not good for anyone else. It makes it difficult. So as a developer, if you were to develop a program that was written in C and used some standard libraries, it might be easy to port that to or from Mac OS to Linux or another Unix, except for the fact that the windowing environment is completely different.
See, I don't have the background to look at it in that level of detail. My feeling about Wayland is pretty much of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And as near as I can tell, X ain't broke. But I think you provide some information and perspective here that a lot of people will find interesting and useful.
Well, again, it's a matter of just going back in history. You know, X has been around a long, 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 long time. Initially designed, I think, by Xerox. And that may be...
I think it's 40 years old or more.
It's almost as old as Unix, but not quite that old. You know, Unix is back in 1968, 1967, 8, 9, depending on your definition of when Unix was created, because it was evolving, and you could point at anything in between that early timeline and say, well, that's where Unix really began. But the idea of having a graphical console, you know, came several years later, and X was developed. Now, when I first started using X, it wasn't X11, it was X10. Not to be confused with those annoying home controller people that pop up on your screen, but I don't remember all of my history. My memory's not as good as it used to be, but I don't remember there being an X9 or X8. You know, I don't know why, if it just jumped to that or whether... I'll just show my ignorance there. I just can't remember. But just to let you know, I mean, I've been using X for way over 20 years. I think since... Yeah, probably before that. And it's always been... was X10 at the time until it became X11. And then even then you have, like, X11 release 3, release 4, release 5, release 6. What are we up to now? Release 7, I think? Or X11... X11 R6. It was... for the longest time, it was X11 R6. And, of course, you remember the whole Xorg versus X386 debacle.
I actually started using Linux just about the time that changeover was around 2005, and I think that changeover was kind of coming to a completion about that point. So I don't have the experience with the previous iterations.
Oh, that's a wonderful story about how open source works. To watch what happened with Xorg versus X386, because X386 was the X server implementation that was used by not just Linux, but BSD, you know, all the free Unixes. And it wasn't being developed fast enough. It wasn't being pushed, and so it was forked. And that's how Xorg was created, and pretty much Xorg just took over. And it's very similar to the kind of forking that you see with, like, OpenOffice and forking into LibreOffice, so... Again, that's what makes Linux and open source very powerful, is the ability to keep things open and to have forks, but it's also its downfall, you know, when it comes to compatibility and lack of centralized control can sometimes hurt, you know, having a vision and moving in a certain direction. So it's that pendulum. I love going back to the pendulum analogy, that everything is that's a good tie back, isn't it, to come back to that. Everything in life philosophically swings from one direction to another as people discover and rediscover the past and look forward to the future. And just to put that back into the frame of Lake Taylor, we use X because it works for us. And it's not always the easy path, as you can imagine, trying to get Linux-based accounting software and other things sometimes can be very difficult. but it's also very cost effective.
I have heard that that's one area in open source where open source tends to be weak, because the classic saying is that where does an open source program come from? It comes from a developer who's scratching his own itch. And a lot of geeks don't have an itch to develop accounting software or CAD software.
Right. And there, and it's not to say that there aren't accounting-based packages. There are. But there are so many individualized markets out there. In healthcare, you know, if you can imagine, billing and accounts receivable, it's very complicated.
And every time insurance companies change a policy or procedure, it's going to cascade down into the billing and the accounts receivable.
Yes. And so there, it's hard to keep up with it. And it's not that our industry is any more complicated than any other industry. Each industry has their own very specific requirements when it comes to different types of software. And when you look at the market now, you know, where the market used to be 90% Unix, and now it's easily 90% Windows-based. So you as a developer trying to make software to make money, to survive in a business environment, you're going to target those markets that are going to make you the most money, and that is not Linux. And so sometimes that hurts us, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's the most cost-effective method, and sometimes it isn't. We're not purely Linux-based at Latail. We do have a Windows 2008 server running Citrix, but it's still centralized. So there are a few applications that we use on that we could not get for Linux. But our preferred choice would be Linux-based, and then preferred over that would be open source over commercial. But again, that's another complicated argument that we could get into, but I don't think people want to hear that, you know, as to, you know, whether commercial or open source, they both have their advantages and disadvantages.
I think if any audience is interested in hearing arguments like that, it would be the audience for Hacker Public Radio. I'll follow your lead, and we won't go there. Going back to your background, were you using Linux? Well, obviously not Linux, because it wasn't around when you got into working for Lake Taylor, but were you using Unix or before you started working with Lake Taylor? Or,
well, if we rewind all the way back to, I'm from Richmond. I'm not from Hampton Roads originally. And my first real computer was the Tandy or TRS-80 color computer 1.
The old Trash 80.
Don't call it Trash 80. I hate it when people did that, especially people using Crappadors, remember? That's what they call Commodore. Well, yeah, my first computer was a Coco 1. It had 4K of RAM. Cassette player, you know, to record your programs and play them back or store them, because it didn't have a floppy drive. Those were way too expensive back then. I had several other little intermediate computers. You know, I'd messed with a Timex Sinclair. I'd played with a lot of other things. A Tandy Model 1. A friend of mine, they had a Model 2 and a Model 3. It was like, woo. And the Model 3 came out. That's about the same time, I think it was the 2 or the 3, is when the Coco 1 came out. And it was a great beginning. I was only 11 years old, so.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how far we've come in just one person's lifetime. And of course, I'm not saying that I'm going to die anytime soon. I hope not. But you look back at, you know, a flash key that can store hundreds of gigabytes in this little teeny chip that you can fit on one of your fingernails. That would just have blown me away back then when we were struggling with 4K of RAM trying to fit things in. And then when the 16K version came out, it's like, oh my god, we'll never need 16K of RAM. I mean, can you imagine that much storage space, or that much working area for your programs? It's unbelievable.
And when I was 11 years old, color television was new.
Not that anyone that's listening wants to date how old we are, but I guess it'll probably be apparent, you know, by, since I wrote down some of these dates as to how we progressed.
Now, you're currently using Red Hat, I think, for your network at Lake Taylor?
Oh, yeah, we're using RHEL. We recently converted.
So what is your personal favorite distro for your home use?
Oh, Lord. I see you wanted to jump off the history and go straight into the meat. As you know, politically, as in TWUG, I try to be as distro neutral as possible, because
and by and large you succeed.
Yeah, I believe that all distros, all Linux distros, have their advantages and disadvantages, and there's a distro for everybody. Sometimes there's more than one distro for everyone. Currently, I lean, and it depends on the purpose. For example, at work we use RHEL and CentOS and Scientific Linux primarily on the servers, on the desktops, which are mostly being used as thin clients anyway. We're converting to Fedora right now, but we've used several other operating systems there. At home, well, actually, I'll just rewind the history because that'll work me right up to it. The Cocoa 1, I ended up getting a Cocoa 2 and then the Cocoa 3. When the Cocoa 3 hit, they were using an operating system that became available then if you had a hard drive, which was amazing, you know, to have a hard drive, God. We were using something called OS 9, and OS 9 was fantastic. And what's interesting about OS 9 is a lot of the concepts in OS 9 came from Unix. So it was, in a weird sort of way, very Unixy. And so that set me up for the stage of being more and more fascinated with that. In 1987, I graduated from high school and moved to Norfolk to attend ODU. And I was on the never-ending plan. You know, it took me like 7 years to get out of there.
ODU being...
Old Dominion University, yes. And, you know, they had Unix machines, a lot of Solaris stuff. There was Sun OS at the time. They didn't have Solaris. You know, that didn't come out until later. The first Linux distro I used... Let's see, I started Lake Taylor at 89, and then, you know, was forced, but it was required to use Xenix because that's what we had. And, of course, for like a lot of people at the time, I wanted to be able to use it at home also. And I'd already built an x86 machine, but there were, you know, back then, there were no free or open or easy to obtain versions of Unix or Xenix. They were all commercial and tremendously expensive. Now, if you were a school, you could get either free or very reduced prices, but for home, there just wasn't an option. So there was a lot of talk about Minix and other things that would be available, but nothing really happened until Linux hit the scene. Now, I was able, somehow, I got some kind of clearance version of interactive Unix. So that was my very first Unix that I had at home. And it worked quite well. They didn't include X. So I remember, oh my God, this was funny. I remember having to download X from school because, you know, they're the only ones that had an internet connection at the time that were universities. And I downloaded it and put it on a tape and got it home. And I had to borrow a tape drive to actually download it because I think it was something ridiculous like, I don't know, it was 10 or 15 megabytes, which at the time was just, oh my God, you know, huge. Exactly. So, but I got it working, and that really got me very interested. And around the same time, you know, Linux was coming out, and wasn't quite stable yet, but as soon as it became good enough to use, I think it was Soft Landing Systems, or SLS, and I remember downloading just reams of floppies. It just took forever on these BBSs and stuff to try and get these floppies. Later came UUCP, you know, to trying to use Unix to Unix copy to get these things off of what was the precursor of the internet, to what we think of as the internet now.
Precursor to the World Wide Web.
Yeah, essentially. And, just floppy after floppy after floppy after floppy for soft landing systems. And that was a little restrictive. And then Slackware came out, of course, and then I moved to Slackware. And then I moved to Red Hat and was really impressed. Red Hat put a lot of effort into polishing it and getting it to be a very useful and easy to install distro. That's all relative, you know, easy. We look at it now, it's like, oh God, it's been many, 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 many hours trying to get X to work or something. And nowadays you just slap it in, it seems like most things work. I was increasingly frustrated with Red Hat. Mandrake came out at the time and was based on Red Hat, and they made a wonderful distro. I switched to Mandrake and started using that. And as you know, their name changed through time and to Mandriva, and that's what they are now, is Mandriva. But I still use what's now Magia, which is the fork, which is the open fork of Mandriva. So I'm using Magia on my desktop right now, and I like it. It's nice. But I've used many other distros too, depending on what purpose. For example, on this EEE computer that I have here, we're actually using an EEE to record my voice now. I was especially impressed with the Asus EEE PC, I think this is 1000. When it came out, it was the first true netbook. You know, they invented the netbook category, and it came with Linux, and it came with...
Was that the one with that Olympus light?
Oh, yeah, it had some awful, I don't know what it was. I immediately took it off and installed something else, but I really don't remember which Linux came on it. It was definitely not for me.
I think it came with a crippled version of Linspire, Fedora maybe? That was called Limpus Lite.
I think it was Linspire or something.
Linspire?
I don't know. There have been several attempts, yeah.
I didn't get a netbook until I was able to get one from Dell, and it came with Ubuntu.
Right.
And now it's trying to get a netbook with Linux on it from Dell is like trying to pull a tooth.
Yeah, I know.
But I quite like, I'm running Salix OS on that one now, and I'm very happy with it as a netbook.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can use it for other things too, but it works like a charm on my netbook, and it got the Broadcom wireless working very easily with instructions on the Salix website, and it's based on Slackware, so of course it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't tolerate the desktop that was installed very quickly because they wanted it dumbed down for your user that didn't understand what Linux was or didn't care. You know, they just wanted a cheap computer that worked. So yeah, I dumped that and installed, I think it was Ubuntu at the time. And that worked very well, and I used that for a few years, and was upgrading that through different versions. And I think I went to just a plain Ubuntu after that on it, and then I switched it over to Fedora, and surprisingly that worked well too. So, because by this time, I mean we all know this from Linux, is especially with laptops and new hardware, it can be a nightmare when you buy a new machine with new chipsets and things, because you know they haven't made it into the kernel and you. So the early days of any laptop is difficult, but after a few years, all the distros had support for it, so you could install anything you want.
I remember having to use Indus Wrapper to get a wireless PCMCIA card working.
Oh yeah,
and it worked. Then I upgraded the computer to a newer version of Slackware, and the Indus Wrapper didn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. But it can be flaky. But yeah, for a long time, wireless was the Achilles heel of Linux, putting Linux on a laptop.
Yes, in fact, that was the big thing, because if you couldn't get on the network, there was pretty no point in using the machine. And nobody wanted to be tethered by an Ethernet cable. It's nice to have, but it's not what you want to primarily use in a portable machine.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. It takes away the portability.
So did I answer your question? I think I did.
We covered the ground, yes. Going back to TWUG, the Tidewater Unix User Group, what are some of the services that TWUG provides to its members?
Well, that's varied over time, but
other than ability to go into a room and when you talk about computers, you're talking with people who actually know what /etc/fstab means.
Yes. Well, it is refreshing if you've never been to a Unix or Linux users group before, especially if Linux interests you, you know, to be around other people that kind of know what you're going with that. I'll probably rewind and give you a little history on TWUG so that you can see how it's evolved.
I'm really curious about, because I know it's been around a long time.
Well, I posted, you know, this stuff is on our website, but you know, sometimes nobody wants to read that. They just want to listen. You know, that way you can listen to this in the car or whatever. But I did not form TWUG. I was there within the first year of its formation. You know, when I started working at Lake Taylor, just to rewind, back in Richmond, I was very active in a users group that helped to form called RACO, which was the Richmond Area Color Computer Organization. And you know, having left there and moved here, and also you know getting into the whole Unix thing, I was looking for a users group. I think I found, I'm not sure we were called TWUG at the time, I think it just kind of stuck. I can't remember exactly when that phrase was coined.
Well, it's easy to pronounce and it's easy to remember, so that gives you a leg up.
It does confuse some people nowadays, you know, when they say, you know, well, I don't want Unix, I want Linux. Well, you know, obviously, you know, Linux is Linux and Unix go hand in hand, but we didn't want to rename the group. And besides, you can't pronounce something that would be like the Tidewater Linux Users Group. It would be TWLUG, you know, it would be kind of weird. Or it could be TLUG, and there's some other history involved in that, but so I did discover them, I think, through ODU. I think there was somebody there that knew somebody that knew someone that put up a flyer that knew somebody else. And that this new users group was just forming called TWUG, and it was meeting at several different locations. I would give...
When was that?
1989. I would credit probably Tom Manos as being driving force behind the creation of the group. And like most developers, you know, if you have an itch, you know, you try to make a scratch to go with it. And I think he probably had need for, at the time, you know, having more support for Unix and getting together with other people in the community to try and share knowledge and learn. And because Tom Manos was forming a company called Wyvern Technologies, which I'm not sure if you remember that, but Bill Roberts was also instrumental. He just died recently, unfortunately.
Oh, I remember something on the website about that.
Right, and he was instrumental in the early days also. But we would meet. There's a very small group. You know, you might have five or six people, and it started growing. I remember one of the key things that happened with TWUG at the time was to try and get on what was the internet or what would be the internet. And the only way you could do that, like I said earlier, was through universities. And this was all happening at the same time I was going to ODU, which was interesting. They had a real connection, you know, through, I guess, not sure if it was still called DARPANET at that point, but for anyone else on the fringe trying to get access, you would go through your local university using UUCP, which was the Unix to Unix copy. It's primarily for email. So Wyvern Technologies, which was the company that was forming to almost be like an internet service provider, Tom Manos bought a high-speed modem for ODU, and ODU provided a UUCP live connection back to their server. So that became kind of the price of admission, was you buy them a modem and they would be happy. You had to buy two, you know, one for yourself and one for them, and they would give you a connection because, you know, the universities were interested in trying to spread this and getting out into the community. And this was before the days really of internet service providers, and that's what Tom was forming, which later became Infinet, as you probably know, Infinet, which was a major, you know, local internet service provider in Hampton Roads with lots and lots of modems. Modems were the way that people connected back then. And anyway, we would call that the Wyvern era of our group, you know, because we met at Wyvern and then later physically met at Infinet, was their building. And the group grew and we had more and more people. We also had Lyman Bird, who's another historic figure of TWUG, and later Ken Long also joined. And they both worked for Metro Machines, and they're a local company that uses Linux. And they hosted our first TWUG website and what was going to be the mail list. So I believe our original mail list was getting back to the internet through UUCP, and it was crazy because you had to use all these. I don't know if you remember this, but back before there was like mark@soandso.org as an email address, you'd have to use bangs. So you'd say like wyvern.chrysanthemum.odu.cs.edu/wyvern/twug/something/. And that's how you'd have to actually route this mail from one place to another. It was complicated.
I don't remember that at all. I was probably just starting to cut my teeth with BBSs.
Yes, now BBSs were still popular. Yes, this was going on all, you know, BBSs have been around a long, long time. But yeah, that was primarily the way that people were communicating, was through bulletin boards. The idea of having live push, as you would think of it now, or push email, where email just comes on its own to your machine, was a fascinating concept that bulletin boards couldn't quite do. And anyway, they hosted that for years, and later we had Lockheed Martin join in with Jerry Massey. That's another name that's kind of, you know, key name at TWUG. And so we would rotate the group meetings between Lockheed Martin and Chesapeake and Infinet in Norfolk. So one month we'd have it at one, next month we'd have it at the other. And then later, you know, sometimes you'd have conflicts and couldn't get the meeting rooms and stuff. So that's how I got involved is, you know, we needed a meeting place. And so I said, well, you know, you could meet at Lake Taylor. I don't have a problem with that. So I offered a meeting room there. And so then we'd have a three-way rotation. And then, or it could have been like at the time Infinet was not available or Tom was not available to be with the group for a while. And I think, you know, without somebody hosting it that's from that organization, it makes it more difficult. Because, you know, a lot of lugs meet at libraries and other public places, but a lot of those public places weren't suitable back then because they didn't have an internet connection, or they don't have a projector, or they don't have a lecture-style meeting room, you know, or they have dues, you know, have to pay to use the room, you know, that kind of thing, or they have very restrictive times or dates that are available for when you could have the meetings.
You have to leave when the library closes,
exactly,
and things like that.
And you know, our target audience are people that mostly are working. So, you know, unless you're going to have the meeting on a weekend, you want to have it probably on a weeknight, and that means that it'll be after work, after dinner. You know, so you have to be available a little bit longer. So, you know, it rotated between Lockheed Martin and Lake Taylor, and then eventually Lockheed Martin dropped out of the picture because we had a lot of security problems. You know, this is, if you look back at the years, at the whole terrorism thing, and so it got harder and harder to get into Lockheed Martin, and so it was just decided, I had no trouble with them just meeting at Lake Taylor permanently, and so that's what's happened. So for many years now, it's been just at Lake Taylor.
One thing I noticed about 12, because I'm primarily a Slackware user, which I think makes me part of a minority. A lot of folks seem to be frightened of Slackware. But I noticed there's a high percentage of Slackware users in 12. Why do you think that might be?
I'm not sure. I mean,
of course, a lot of them seem to me to be old Unix heads.
Exactly. And I think that, again, we have a large, what I would say, conservative group of people that have been around a long time and have been using different distros. And people that are more conservative tend to not like things like Ubuntu. They'll probably gravitate more towards the older distros like Slackware or Red Hat. Even Mandriva at this point would be considered an old distro.
Debian's what I use on my file server at home.
Yeah, Debian's been around a long time. And we have, at TWUG, we have, you know, every possible kind of person you can imagine. And there is no one audience. You know, we have people that work, people that don't, people that go to school, people that are young, old, of every nationality, race, religion, age, gender. Yeah.
Hardware hackers, software hackers.
Yeah, and it's just, it's impossible.
Kernel hackers.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that's one of the more difficult things about TWUG. Yeah, we have had people, you know, that are programmers and people that do this for a living, people that just do it as a hobby, people that are beginners, people that are experts. It's difficult to have one group that meets the needs or expectations of everyone. Well, it's just impossible.
It's impossible to even try. And I think someone who's interested in a group like TWUG or any other hobbyist or interest groups learns they either have to be willing to accommodate aspects of that interest they're not particularly interested in for the larger sense of being part of the community.
Right. It can be very difficult to find topics that are interesting. Plus, I'm kind of burned out because I've been doing this for so many years, since 1989. A lot of times people won't step forward to give presentations. I know you've given several presentations, and I appreciate that. And we always are looking for more people to present on all different kinds of levels or topics. But a lot of times it comes down to me having to give a presentation at every single meeting, and there's just only so many things I can talk about.
But I know some of the most interesting meetings, from my standpoint, have been the ones where there was no topic.
Yes.
And people started talking about, you know, what was bothering them at the moment, whether it was a problem on their computer. And sometimes those are the meetings with the highest amount of laughter and fun.
That's true, especially at my expense, you know, that people love to tease me. But
don't be too hard on yourself. We'll do that for you.
No, I've done that several times, and nervously at first, you know, where we just didn't have a topic, because a lot of members were, well, I don't want to drive out there and be there if you're not going to have a prearranged, you know, schedule of who's going to talk about what and why, and I can certainly appreciate that. But at the same time, some of these open meetings have been, I think, some of the most enjoyable ones, because you'll get people talking that don't normally talk. And I don't want each meeting to be just one way, where a speaker is presenting and people are listening, and then maybe there's a question and answer session if you're lucky, and then that's it, and you go home. A few meetings have been that way, only because of time constraints or, you know, what's covered, but the interactivity of bringing people in and who has a question or what's a topic we can talk about. And it can be off the wall because, again, the Tidewater Unix Users Group, our mission is not just Linux or Unix. It's also free and open source software. And there's so many devices that use Linux now and open source software. I mean, Android is the world's number one platform for mobile experience devices now, and that's Linux-based. So we don't want to drag it down into being an Android users group, but having that in the mix is interesting. People talk about Google or what they're doing and knowing that they have hundreds of thousands of servers that are all Linux-based. So there's a lot of different topics.
So what are some, you mentioned the website, what are some of the other services TWUG provides?
Well, we've had a website for a long time, and we tried, you know, it is a wiki, and that didn't work out so well when it came to contributions. We did have some people contribute to it, like Matthew Philpott. I don't want to say that there weren't people that put a lot of effort into it, but we had some problems with spamming, and it just didn't work out quite so well. Of course, we've always had the mail list, which has been the most important thing. Recently, we just added a discussion forum, which is based on PHPBB, and that was could have been a little controversial, but I think it's been going quite well. It's just still in its infancy right now. We have 26 people that have signed up for it. I'm always asked, well, how many members are there in TWUG? And it's hard to say. You know, a lot of organizations have dues, and we don't have dues. That's one of the things I've never wanted to do, is to have any kind of charge. We've made money that we needed to in the past by selling discs or by doing little fundraiser things if we needed to, but we've never really needed money because, you know.
Well, for one thing, you don't have to pay for a meeting room.
Right.
And for a lot of organizations, like TWUG, the meeting room and paying for meetings is the biggest expense.
Either that or hosting. Hosting services can be expensive too, but those have been donated also. Metro's Machine has been doing that, like I said, for many years at no cost. I've now since moved that over to Lake Taylor, so the servers are now there, and Lake Taylor is providing the bandwidth and the server, so which is good. It's good for Lake Taylor, it's good for the community, it's good for TWUG, it's good for all of us. And I like that these services can be free. But I think, you know, the whole point of TWUG is not that, although I say the mailing list or the forums, you know, are a major benefit of TWUG, I would think that the most important thing is the monthly meeting. And the reason I say that is because, you know, with the internet the way it is now, there are hundreds of lugs, thousands of lugs all over the world. And, you know, you can go to a forum or discussion group like linuxquestions.org and just have thousands and thousands and thousands of people asking and answering questions, and there are blogs, there are how-tos.
There are even some online logs that meet regularly using, like, Mumble. I know Linux Basics has an online log that meets before they record their weekly podcast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, nowadays you could use Google Hangouts, you could use all kinds of things, but I try to encourage people, or try to remind people, that in the past, having a meeting was required. It was the only way you could really effectively communicate and learn. That's not true anymore, but I think that's what makes TWUG special, is it's physical. So you're actually going to a place and meeting people and reading people's expressions and getting the vibe of the room and staying after the meeting to talk to somebody about something geeky or asking for help on something specific.
A virtual meeting, however much goodwill and friendliness there is in it, is still virtual, and it's not quite the same as face. It's an attempt to recreate the face-to-face experience because people know they need the face-to-face experience, but it's not the same. Maybe when we all have holographs of ourselves, we can all go to the holodeck for our lug meeting, it will be the same. But yeah, I agree. I come not because of what I might learn at the meetings, because oftentimes the meetings don't address anything that's really new to me, or alternatively, it addresses something that's so foreign to what I'm interested in, I just don't care. Like Matt's presentation about the Desura game thing.
You're not a gamer, so that doesn't really interest you.
Yeah, I decided long ago I wasn't going to be a gamer because I don't have the time to get good, and I'm already mediocre at enough things, so I don't want to add another thing to that list.
Right.
I think we've been going quite nicely here for quite a while. One question, though, and I think a lot of HPR listeners would also be interested in this, though it's not about Linux, but you've recently gotten a Windows 8 computer, I understand.
Yes.
As someone who's proficient in using both systems, because we were talking the other day and you mentioned you always kept a Windows computer on hand because there are sometimes things you have to do that require that operating system. And I keep one on hand too. Actually, it's quite a nice computer except for the operating system. What's your first impression of Windows 8?
Well, I have to say that there are some things that are really flashy and very interesting, especially, I'll just preface this by saying my last home portable machine was an EEE, that was actually the EEE PC I was talking about earlier, the EEE 1000, and you know that's several years old now, and it's time for something a little bigger. I needed a higher resolution screen, more memory, faster processor, and I've been just kind of looking to see what was available, and something caught my fancy. It was a Lenovo Twist, which is one of these new touchscreen ultrabooks. And it has a flippable screen where you can twist it around and put it flat and use it as a tablet or not. I'm not sure if I'll ever use that feature, but it just seemed like a nice thing to have. I compared lots of different machines. The Lenovo one, in my mind, only because it had a real Ethernet port. It had, it had a quality build. It had enough memory. There was an 8 gig of memory option where most of them were 4. And I really wanted a solid state hard drive, just like I have in this EEE, no moving parts, not and more reliable and faster. So I opted for that, knowing, of course, that it was going to come with Windows 8, whether I wanted it or not. Now, I'm very outspoken about that. I think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with wanting to use MS Windows if that's what you want to use, but I think it's really wrong that it's almost impossible to buy a machine of your choice without having to pay the Microsoft tax, you know. That said, you know, I've always had some machine somewhere around that has Microsoft Windows on it. A perfect example is my Sony DSLR camera. You know, I need to do a firmware update. Well, they don't give you any other way to do that except with a Windows program, and so I have to have some access somewhere, even if it means going to someone else's house, but I don't want to have to inconvenience somebody else just to do that. Otherwise, I'd say I spend all my time, you know, my main computer here at home doesn't have Windows on it at all. So... but I still have that an old laptop that has that on it. Now, it's aging, too. It's like Windows XP Service Pack 2 or something. So I expect at some point those little utility programs I may occasionally run into that I need to run won't even run on that. So I thought having a dual boot wouldn't hurt. This in this case, being forced to buy the license, it could be useful. But, you know, I opened the thing up and was playing with it, and, man, they've really changed the user interface. It's a radical departure from Windows 7, from XP, or Vista. You know, we forget that Vista exists, but it really did. I think that there are some parts of it that are extremely frustrating, especially from someone that wants to just get certain tasks done. Like, I wanted to know, how can I repartition the drive? How can I see this? How can I do that? I can't even find, there's no start menu. You have to search for things in order to find anything. Of course, you know, coming from, I'm used to jumping from different desktops, you know, KDE and GNOME and LXDE and different environments and different distros, so I can be frustrated pretty easily, but at the same time, I think I'm pretty flexible. I'm used to working with a lot of different machines, but even I was thrown for kind of a loop. And that's on top of all the extreme complication, because, you know, my first objective is to repartition the thing and get Linux on it, because that's what I want to use on my new machine. And in order to do that, oh, I spent countless hours trying to understand this very oppressive licensing scheme that Microsoft has gotten into bed with all their OEMs and forcing them to turn Secure Boot on. And the Windows key is now stored in the BIOS. It's not stored on the machine. And
you know, a lot of us have known that was coming since it first got publicized about 9 months or a year ago.
Right, I knew it was coming too, but it was one of those things where I figured it. By the time it became a problem or I needed to deal with it, somebody else would have had a solution. Well, surprise, I did find out by complete accident. I'm just lucky, you know, because I couldn't get this information from Lenovo, unfortunately, that, you know, you can turn off, in the Lenovo, you can turn off Secure Boot. And it looks like so far, I haven't successfully installed Linux on it yet because I just got it yesterday. So I'm still working on it. But it looks like you can turn off Secure Boot and it still boots Windows. But oh my god, it's got like six partitions on it with all these weird names that I've never seen before. I don't know what they're for.
That's up too, from Windows 7 comes with four.
Right, so at least Lenovo's version of it came with six, and I'm not going to list them all now, because this, but, you know, just trying to sit there and go through different forums to figure out what are these, and can I get rid of it, and because it's so locked down in the BIOS with the EFI or UEFI BIOS situation, you have the legacy BIOS, you have the new BIOS, you have with it locked, with it not locked, you have the bootloader and the way it's tied to it. It took me an hour just to find out where to make a system recovery disk for this thing, which was difficult.
In other words, as a knowledgeable, experienced computer user of many different operating systems, it would be fair to say that you find Windows 8 to be a real pain in the anatomy.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing that was shocking was, you know, is I'm buying a... I knew it didn't have a lot of storage space. It's 128 gig solid state. But when you find out that only, what was it, like 50 gigabytes are available, 50 to 60, after all the crap that's loaded. I mean, they
holy yeah. moly!
Well, they divided it up into all these little partitions, you know, and they had the recovery partition and this and that and the other, and there wasn't as much junkware on there as I expected, probably because they just didn't have space. But, you know, what I would want to do typically is get rid of the partitions I don't need. You know, the traditional way of doing this, make it as small as possible, remove all the crap, make a backup of it, repartition it down real small, and then have Linux take over the rest of it and use that primarily. But if I'm frustrated and I know what I'm doing, I guess most people look at it and it's just pretty. You know, you've got you can use the gesture, since it is a touchscreen based one, you can flip things around it. But as soon as you try to start doing anything a little more complicated than touching something and pulling something up, it becomes frustrating. So,
well, this Windows 7 computer I got, which was a gift from someone I did a lot of blog posts to his website for him over to generate more content for a number of years, and he had one of these fall into his hands. It's a gorgeous tablet, touchscreen. The touchscreen worked just fine under Mint, by the way. But when you get beneath the glitz of the much wanted Aero desktop and the visual effects underneath, it doesn't look much different from Windows NT 4. I want to thank you very much. I appreciate time. I've learned a lot in talking with you, and anyone who sticks with it through the course of this conversation, I think will learn a lot. I'll make sure that in the show notes there will be links to the 12 website and forum, so if anyone's interested, because the website and the forum and the mailing list are certainly not limited to any particular geographical area. And thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your taking the time to further promote TWUG and Linux.
If you want to email me, you can email me at frank@pineviewfarm.net. Pineview Farm is all one word, no spaces, no punctuation. And my website is www.pineviewfarm.net. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.